This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
This is E.O. Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network News.
The Humanist Network News.
It's February 24th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production of the American Humanist Association. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Jenda Huang.
We are podcasting live, but we are not at the Stephen Yule Imagine No Superstition Studio. Jenda, what's going on there?
I'm down here in Washington, D.C., still trying to dig myself out of all the snow that we've been having. The office was actually closed for a week, so that kind of put us back in terms of everything. So that is why I am down here this week.
Well, and now you have gracefully and graciously given upstate New York all of your snow because I'm shoveling myself out. So neither of us could travel.
Exactly. Yeah, I heard there's a big storm coming your way, or I guess it's already arrived.
Yeah, we've already gotten a foot, and I think we're probably going to get another foot, which I know, you know, upstate New York, we're used to that. You folks down in D.C., however, we're not used to that.
Yeah, no, we were out of the office for an entire week because there was just the metro was closed, the roads were clogged. No one here knows how to drive in the snow.
Yeah, no such luck up here in upstate New York. Our world continues. All right, Jenna, we got a great show for our listeners this month. Why don't you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, we did an interview with Sebastian Velez, who is from Harvard, and he happened to be going down to Haiti right when the earthquake struck back in early January and was able to kind of give us a firsthand report of what it was like down there. And he had also worked with Humanist Charities, which is the charitable arm of the AHA, to deliver supplies to a town in Haiti that hadn't seen any aid yet before he arrived there.
That's right, Jenna. So we're going to talk to Sebastian not only about what he did recently in Haiti with the earthquake and with his relief efforts, but also about the work that he's been doing in Haiti for the past decade or so. So he's been studying at Harvard University. He's currently a PhD candidate in organismic and evolutionary biology. But before studying at Harvard, he went to the University of Notre Dame and received his master's in biological sciences. And even before that, he went to the University of Puerto Rico and got his bachelor's in the agriculture department.
Yeah, most of his studies are focused on island biogeography and systematics, which is kind of the study of the diversification of life and how certain species ended up where they're at. So he's kind of studying like the history of evolution on our planet.
That sounds pretty awesome. So Jen and I interviewed Sebastian last Friday. Sebastian Velez, thank you so much for speaking with HNN. I guess it'd be good for our listeners first if we could just make a connection between the work that you've been doing in Haiti and your involvement in the humanist community. So can you talk a little bit about that?
First, I'm a humanist. Here at Harvard, I am a member of the Harvard Secular Society of the Skeptics, Humanists, and something like that, grad students. One of those organizations that changes names every year, and the humanist chaplaincy. But I'm also a member of the American Humanist Association, and our project in Haiti is mostly funded by humanist organizations. So we receive money from religious people, of course, and with everybody, but really our primary funding comes from the Norwegian Humanist Association through, it's called the HAMU, H-A-M-U, and they do, it's the part that deals with human rights. And they fund organizations around the world that have to do with human rights. And then the American Humanist Association has also funded us in the past. If I recall well, they gave us a funds for a school library. And the time they gave us funds was for a house that we rent in town, in which we bring pregnant women who are in the forest. And we bring them, and they can stay in the house while they are about to give birth. So that's our involvement. So they knew about us and our work, and it's been, 2-3 years since we've been working with the American Humanist Association. It's funny, I guess, or I like to tell the story. We were arriving from New Zealand, and I call our people in Haiti, and they tell us, the earth just shook. I was in L.A. on my way to the Dominican Republic. And then I have a stopover here at Boston, and I'm on the plane, and they call me from the American Humanist Association saying, we know that you work in Haiti. Is there a way that we can help the people there? And that's how the funding came for this relief effort.
Okay, so you were already on your way over there anyway, just doing sort of a routine visit?
Exactly, yeah. We had a water chlorination project that we were starting. So we always have babies die. And it's one of our main concerns. Actually, we started this as an education program, and that's how we had asked the American Humanist Association for funds for the school library and all of these things. But the problem is that the children are dying and around us, and they come hungry to school and with obvious signs of malnutrition. And then you go to their houses, and they're either taking care of their siblings or they're really sick with diarrhea and really simple stuff.
Right.
So we ended up doing a lot of emergency, medical emergency work. And we were having, 3 to 5 babies die a month.
Wow.
That we would know in the community. And then we did a survey, a health survey, and we realized that almost every single woman wanted to have contraception or use contraception.
Oh, really?
So we started distributing contraceptives, and that really brought the amount of babies dying down. And last year, we had 2 babies die in the year.
That's amazing.
And one of the reasons that we had babies dying was not just people who did not want the babies and were not able to take good care of them. It was a diarrhea. And then, so we did some tested for E. coli, for contaminants in the water, and very few people were using chlorination, even though bleach is
readily available.
Thank you. So we started this water chlorination project. We got the funding. We got a special dispenser that was designed for use in Kenya, and it gives an exact dose of the amount of bleach that you need to chlorinate 5 gallons of water.
Okay.
So we had planned this trip like 4 months ago, and that's when the humanist called, when we were on our way.
So were you still able to actually carry out that project?
Yes. It was with Harvard undergrads, and they really helped a lot. And these are people who work very hard, and they already had interest, of course, in the project. And I was going to work on a regular project, and they already had their work planned out for the water chlorination.
Right.
So and they were not allowed. Harvard sent a letter as soon as the earthquake hit that they did not want Harvard students in Haiti because of their safety concerns, but also because you always get this flow of people running into disaster zones.
Right.
And they have no medical training. They have no training working with NGOs, and they're really more a liability for the organizations and for the Haitian people.
Right.
Or the people who are in distress than the actual help that they bring, good intentions or not. So I could not bring my students into Haiti.
Okay.
Or did not want to anyway. So, yeah, we were able to finish the project, the water chlorination. And I just spoke with the people there, and it's working very well.
Oh, I'm glad.
And the good thing about bringing people is that people get motivated and they see the issues. One thing is for me to tell you that we have people, kids suffering from a and lack of proteins, and they have their extended bellies and they're very thin and a lot of that. Another thing is for you to actually see a kid, a 4-year-old kid, naked and in the dirt and full of parasites and malnourished.
Right.
So even though the students and the people that we bring there do not necessarily bring skills to treat that that boy or that baby.
Right.
When they come back, they come with their eyes wide open and they start working on fixing the situation. So we just bought a ton of, it's a nutritional supplement that it's called, if I remember the name, Plumpy Nut. And it's made, it's a high protein mix, it's like a paste. And you feed the children 3 times a day with this paste. And it's very high in protein, so it reduces the effect of the malnutrition because of lack of protein.
Right. It gives them the nutrients that they need to develop.
Exactly. At least they can develop. And then we can work on with their parents, because that is the main issue, of course, in Haiti and in Dominican Republic, is a lack of employment. You can bring all the medicines and you can bring all the aid that you want, but if people don't have work to make a living, as soon as you leave and as soon as your funding is over, they're going to go back to the same position.
Right. This is just one other kind of disaster that's been happening in Haiti, right? There have been this sort of a long history of struggle with the government and with the economy.
It's very interesting that when people ask me about Jacmel, which is the city that we brought all the aid from sent by the humanists, and I tell them that it was only like 600 to 1,000 dead people, and they were like, "Were you shocked with the dead people and whatnot?" And I tell them, "No, like Haiti goes through an earthquake every single day."
Right.
Everything in Port-au-Prince, it was not normal because it was a lot of cement. And there is not normal in Haiti. You don't see a lot of cement in Haiti. And that's what all the big things happening in Port-au-Prince, even though it was not the epicenter of the earthquake. But it's because it was the place where things could get destroyed.
Right.
But the thing of people camping outside in the park and whatnot, those pictures are not shocking at all. If you go to Haiti, to central Haiti, where the peasants are, those people, their daily lives are much worse than the people who are right now suffering from the aftermath of the earthquake.
Wow.
Right now, as we speak.
So that's even a step up from some of the villages in the more impoverished areas of Haiti any day of the year. That's what you're saying?
Definitely. Those people have a little tents, and they have some. I mean, you can tell from their cheeks of the babies and of the people, they have some fat accumulated on their necks and on
right.
their cheeks and whatnot. And I'm not saying, of course, that it's that they're doing well. They're definitely not doing well, especially people who got amputations and got were in a house when the roof fell down. But why are we not all the time in this crisis mode with Haiti? Because Haiti is going through this every single day.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit more on what the situation was in Haiti when you first arrived with all of your supplies? Like, what was the feeling like then?
That's an important question, which I always like to speak about, because that same day, if you saw CNN, you will see Haitians with machetes attacking the convoys with aid. And then you had two Dominicans who had tried to cross from the border with aid into Port-au-Prince, and I think they had been stabbed, and maybe one of them was killed. And that was the general feeling of the whole thing, is that, these people are so, barbaric, that even when you try to come with aid, they attack you with machetes and whatnot. And that, of course, is not true. That is not Haiti. We get there, and there's like 300 people in the port. And the UN is, with their machine guns, like holding them down. And if you have no experience there, you think that's what's happening, is that, there's this horde of people trying to take over and get in the boat or trying to get things away from you. I know there were people who, the first boat full of aid had just arrived. So they went to port to see what was going on. And then they wanted to help unload it. And so we told the people from the UN, can you let some people come out and help us? And like 100 guys came out, and they were, they got to work immediately.
Right.
And they unloaded that truck in which ship. It took us to load that ship maybe 12 hours, and those guys unloaded it in a couple hours.
Wow.
And it's a lot harder to unload it than to load it, because it was in the middle of the boat. So, and that was the general feeling. And then I got into a truck with one of them, the people that we were going to send things to the orphanage. And we were around town. And then the time we left, with the list of things that the hospital needed. And when I came back 2 days later, I just ventured to town by myself with my camera. And I carry around a $10,000 camera. I have a professional camera with me. And I don't look Haitian. Nobody attacked me with a machete, and people gave me directions whenever I wanted, and I bought some food and ate some food and went back to the boat. It was not a big deal, and that is the sense when you go to Haiti. Now, if you go to Port-au-Prince, it's a different story, because it's a city, and like any city, you have people who are more wise guys, and they know about tourists, and they know, I guess, what a camera costs and things like that. Well, it's like you're going into Latin America. Like, probably the most dangerous part of the Dominican Republic is the tourist zone of the Dominican Republic, because people who are looking to mug tourists are there, where
right.
the tourists are. But if you go where the peasants are, and you go all around the country, it's safe. Like, I've never had any problems in 12 years of traveling into the Dominican Republic. I've never had a trouble. And into Haiti, I've never feel threatened in Haiti. And that is the general feeling when you get to the country, is that people are just thankful that you're there. They know what you come to do, and they treat you as a normal person. And I'm sure there are criminals out there, and I'm sure that if I were walking at 4 in the morning, somebody would mug me, but I would not walk at 4 in the morning in Boston either.
Right, yeah, absolutely. So you went down there. Were you representing the Harvard Humanist Chaplaincy and the American Humanist Association? Did you sort of come with the understanding that you were doing work from the humanist movement?
Exactly. So that is a sensitive topic when you are here in the United States, but it's not a sensitive topic when you go down there.
Okay.
But I'm careful because, of course, the money that I get it from here. So I always have to be very careful with our donors and whatnot, so we are on the same page. But when you go down there, you're providing aid and you're helping people, and people really don't care where you come from. They always assume that you are a missionary.
Right.
Exactly. It's always the case. They ask me, from what church do you come from? Or they ask you, or the people tell you, you just provided healthcare to one of their children. And I say, well, I thank Jesus for bringing you here.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, I'm not Christian. And, I missed the call from Jesus. I'm like a little sarcastic, but playful. Like, well, I must have missed the call from Jesus because he didn't call me here. I just, I'm not Christian. And I'm just here.
Right.
And instead of getting offended, people are like, oh, well, no problem.
That's good.
Like, you're just not Christian.
Right.
So it's not a big issue for them. I'm very careful with it because I don't want to be seen as proselytizing humanism. I'm like trying to exchange like goods and aid and whatnot in exchange for, oh, now you have to accept my my philosophy or whatnot.
Right.
But not proselytizing is actually a way of proselytizing for humanism, because you are telling people, hey, I'm not Christian, and you don't have to accept anything that I, any legal books or any fables
exactly.
or stories or anything in order to get anything. And there are people out there who just want to help you because they think it's the right thing to do.
Right, and because you're human.
Yeah, exactly. And people open up. So we have the wife of a minister with a... They do this a lot, and you see how I explain you all of these topics with a lot of trepidation, I guess. I'm making a lot of explanations because here they're very sensitive, but they're not sensitive there. People ask me to baptize kids all the time, and I tell them, well, I'm not Christian, so I would gladly help you with baptizing the kid and whatnot, but you have to understand that it's not a... I'm not receiving a message from God or anything
right.
to do this, but it's an honor. They want, they care for you so much, and they want to give you the honor of, it's not sponsoring, like we'll say here, but like being the overseer of their child,
right?
Being the godfather of their child, because now it does establish like a kinship relationship between you and the parents. Now you are compadres, and they call you compadre when they call you, which means you are like my co-parenting godfather of
okay.
the child. And then the kid dies a few months later from a easy to treat disease, and these are parents who are don't really follow directions that we give them about the doctors and whatnot. And the point is that the kid died, and so I'm there, and the guy is arguing with me about God sending you in, and I argue with him like, I'm an atheist, I don't pray. My kids are home healthy and fat and, going to school. And look at you, man. Like, you're praying all the time and, you're a minister and everything, and your children are dying.
Right.
And we baptized your child, and look what happened. It doesn't cross your mind. And he's like, giving us reasons and whatnot, but behind him, his wife and all of his kids are nodding their heads. Like, yeah. You're right. Like, this is not right.
They're catching on, right?
Exactly. That our sister and the wife, of course, she was very distraught and very upset because of the death of her child. And it's interesting because I was not making an argument for them to leave their religion or whatnot, but just by speaking with them and telling them, hey, there's an alternative view, an alternative explanation to all of these things. And it's that the prayer doesn't work. And it's that you don't need to accept Christianity in order to have people help you.
Right.
And have solidarity with you. And just that is a type of facilitization. And then people approach you and say, hey, I hear that you don't believe in God. And they start speaking. It's like, you go have a beer and people start speaking about it. Because out of the sun, they can be in the open because they know that, hey, there's this guy here who... everybody works with, and he gets along with everybody, and he seems to, and he's not Christian.
Yeah, that's good.
So in that sense, I represent humanism, and I also label everything that the humanists bring, of course, very proudly, like I'm a humanist, and I want mm-hmm. everybody to know that we are not imposing Christianity or anything, any religion on you for accepting aid.
Right.
But I don't distribute pamphlets, and
right,
it's not
right.
a big quid pro quo exchange. And it's another experience is that people have come and said, Dominicans, for example, who don't need the aid, have come and said, how do I become a humanist?
That's great.
And I said, well, that's very nice, you know, but this is just an organization, you know, you pay your dues and you receive your newsletter, and I guess you don't have to pay your dues, you just declare yourself a humanist. When there was a guy, this was the last time that somebody asked me for that, like, oh, I want to be a humanist like you and whatnot. The people around them were like, no, not this guy. No, you know, not everybody can be a humanist like you, Sebastian. Like, people need to, you know, have, like, you know, hold their morals and whatnot, and we don't know if this guy is really good. I said, well, this is interesting how an atheist is, you know, is supposed to have higher morals and higher standards than a Christian.
That's interesting.
So just by doing our work, we promote the cause of a humanist.
I think that's great. And I was just wondering, you know, going through something like having your child die at such a young age, whether or not knowing that they're able to prevent it from medicine or from chlorinating their water, do you think that that's something that makes people's faith stronger because they turn to God because they need God to help them get through? Or do you think that's something, do you see people also start to question their religion? I know that you're there and you're telling them your perspective, and that probably starts wheels turning in at least some of the family members' heads, like you said. But what do you think, having such an experience like that, or for that matter, an experience like living in the city where the earthquake struck and you're seeing buildings coming down, does that make people's faith stronger or weaker, do you think?
Oh, it's a difficult question, because I think that it makes their faith weaker, because it's in your face. And it would be a racist argument to say that Haitians are not as smart as we are and they cannot figure out these things by themselves. And I think they can. And I think they do. But on the other hand, they are as smart as we are in being polite to people who are providing the aid and helping them out.
Right.
So you see, that's why only people who know me and I've spoken about humanism, because we are in a low stress situation again, and we're having a beer or having lunch or whatever, and then the topic comes up, and then we are able to speak about, you know, what do you really think about these things? You know, how come God, you know, you thank God for sending the aid, but you don't thank God for, or you don't blame God for the earthquake itself.
Right.
And most of them are very open, but I would be fooling myself if I didn't also know that, or if I didn't acknowledge that they might also be trying to please me.
Right.
Just like they say to every missionary, they say, thank Jesus for sending you.
Right.
These are complex human beings, like we are. And you have, like, on every society, you have a bell curve in which everybody's in the middle, and you have your very smart people, and you have your very not-so-smart people.
Sure.
And there are people who live here and will have all the education in the world will still believe that things were, God's will. And death was a way of God testing us, our faith.
Right.
And whatnot. And do you know what a falsifiable hypothesis is? And you have Haitians who've never heard the word hypothesis, but think that way.
Mm-hmm.
And they every time you make an argument, and they argue with me, and they win arguments all the time against me, because they put it the other way. And they say, well, how can you falsify that? What if the other thing will say? Will you say the opposite argument and whatnot? And that is just saying the word, is your hypothesis falsifiable, even though we're not using the word, those words. So, it's a complex question. You know, how much do they lean into religious explanations for natural disasters? Yes, as a humanist, I'm going to bet deep down that they really question it.
Mm.
Like, you have to, when your children die, From things like this, you get upset. I'm gonna bet that doesn't go well in their minds. That with politeness and everything, I don't think that goes well in their minds.
I only asked because I was watching, you can see all these videos online of what it looks like in Haiti right now, and I saw a very short video where there was someone, talking about some of the chaos that's happening in the city, like you mentioned, where people are now having to fend for themselves in a way that maybe they're not used to. and it looks chaotic behind the camera, but then you can hear this person talking about, we're just thanking God that we were just, you know, one step, we're just getting one day after one day, we're just taking one step in front of the other, and that's all we can do, and we're just so thankful for God. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, how is that possible to be in that situation, watching the chaos happening around you and thanking God? That it just, it struck me as odd, that's all. So I was just curious, you know, what you saw in your conversations down there.
Well, you also have to tease apart what people say and actually think through. So I'm an atheist, as non-religious as you can get, as an evolutionary biologist, as a scientist.
Right.
And I really thought about all of these issues and philosophically and all of that. And one thing that I catch myself saying all the time is that the best thing that God made was one day after the other. So when I cannot finish my work in one day, and I'm around people, I find myself saying things like that.
Yep.
Because I grew up saying things like that, you know, around my family. And with that, you just mean, like, you know, the best thing in life is that, you know, tomorrow the sun will come up again, and you get to do that work again. So don't worry about the work you have to do tomorrow. Do as much as you can today and do it tomorrow. But I still say things like that. And I also say, el muerto quiere ceniza, which means when somebody offers you an obvious question, like, do you want food when you're hungry? You in Puerto Rico, you always reply, dead guy, do you want a mass? Because that's the last rite that they give you in the Catholic Church. After you're dead, they, like, forgive all of your sins, so then you can go straight to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, all dead people want a mass, because all dead people seem to want to go to heaven. And I still say those things. So you see, with just somebody saying something like that in the earthquake, like, thank God, you know,
sure,
that at least
sure.
We have one day after the other, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're thinking through it. Because if I say them, man, you know, anybody can say them, because I am not just not religious, but pretty much anti-religious on most of my philosophical stances.
Sure, that's a good point. It could just be a euphemism or a saying. Yep, that's a good point.
I was kind of curious, Sebastian, to know, I mean, are you planning to go back to Haiti anytime in the near future, or to kind of see more in terms of relief efforts or anything like that?
On the relief efforts, what we've been doing is sending medicine. So after we finished with the work with the American Humanist Association, that we sent, I think it was the last $20,000 worth of medicines there. The Norwegians contacted us, the Norwegian Humanist Association, that they wanted to send, I think it was $5,000 that they got from their membership. And since we still have our collaborations working there, and we have not just collaborations on paper or people we spoke on the phone, but the people we met there in Haiti, that we know that they're doing work, and we know that everything's going to go well. And these are mostly Spanish organizations. What we're doing is coordinating logistics from here. So I send the money to the credit union, then contact the trucks and send the money to the deposit the money on the bank account of the medicine distributorship. They use very little credit cards or checks in the Dominican Republic, and that's usually the way you do transactions. You go with cash to the bank and deposit it into somebody else's account. And then they call the bank and get a confirmation that the money was actually deposited. So our employees are doing that, and so people wire money and we buy medicines. And I am planning on returning. I used to go 4 to 6 times a year, but it really depends on my teaching schedule.
Okay.
We don't have a big presence in the city of Jacmel and in Haiti proper. And that's something that we've always wanted to do. We work with Haitians on the Dominican side, Haitian immigrants. And the conditions are not, you know, a bit better than they are in Haiti. The misery is the same. And it's hard to say that Haitians or Haiti is the poorest country of the Americas, because when you go to some slums in Nicaragua and you know, peasants in El Salvador and in Guatemala, for example, how can you say that somebody's richer than the other because they have two pots, you know, two metal pots and one machete, and the other family only has one pot and, you know, and one machete?
Right,
These are like absolute dirt, poverty, which people live in dirt homes, and everything that they own is made from materials that they found on the forest. And it's not even misery as in slum misery, because at least in people who live in slums, they have access to bits of plastic and bits of metals and things. These people, not even that. So it's like a, you know, like rock age. It's like everything is made out of rocks and dirt and straw. And, you know, then they have one machete in the house and maybe two spoons and a and I'll, you know, calderon, and everybody eats from there and takes a turns with a spoon. And they eat on their, when you give them rice, they put their shirts up and you pour the rice on the shirt, and they eat, you know, with their hands from the shirt. So to that level of extreme poverty. So it's not that the work that we do in the Dominican Republic, we don't have a justification to say, oh, we need to get out of the Dominican Republic and go into Haiti because things are worse there. You cannot get any lower than that in terms of, you know, of making a living of being poor.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there is a lot to be said for being in Haiti proper and doing work in there. And now with the collaborations that we established in Jacmel, I think we're almost ready for that. We're almost ready to move into Jacmel and start our work there, especially with the issues of orphanages and schools. And I know you heard this case about the Baptists who were transporting 33 children across the Dominican border. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Even from the beginning, when I started hearing these stories, you could tell that those people either had very malicious intentions or were incredibly stupid and inexperienced, because you never do something like that. You know, Haiti might be in chaos, but people know enough not to put children in a bus.
Right.
Or if anybody will see me with a black child, you know, in my arms, like trying to cross a border, even if it was just one black child, I will be stopped by the police. And even though I know everybody and I know the police and I know the military there, they will not let me get away with something like that, you know. And that is just you know, outrageous what they were trying to do. And the zone where they were trying to take the children is right with prostitution. With what they said, it was they had like a building they were renting or whatnot. That's in Cabaret. The Cabaret is like the, you know, capital of prostitution of the Dominican Republic, of the northeast of the Dominican Republic. But regardless, I think that's a good example of the problems in Haiti, is that people have children that they cannot take care of because they don't have access to contraception even though they want it. So if you tell people we have an orphanage, people will give up their children immediately. And I get offers to take people's children from them, you know, and take care of them for them all the time. We all do. Because, you know, they know that whatever care you're going to give to the child is better than the care they can give it. They can give, especially if a newborn, you're still not that attached to that newborn. And he or she has not lived through misery. So they want to have, you know, that baby to experience a good life. But at the same time, I don't like the idea of the orphanage. So I think that we humans could do something like a boarding school or like a school, you know, community school, in which you could have the children go to school and, you know, receive a good education, get receive good meals, and
right.
receive good medical attention, and then go at night to their parents, which are the people who should be taking care of them. And it's not because of ideological reasons, but I think... because it's the right thing to do for the children.
Right.
You know,
I'm
sure they want to be with their parents. So I think that's a next step for us, a next natural step is to work in that area, along with contraception, of course. Which is,
definitely.
That is the very, very basic part of the problem.
Now, how can, if people want to donate to, like, Children of the Border or kind of help out when you go back to Haiti, what's the best way for them to do that?
So we have two ways, of course. One of them is through the American Humanist Association. That is a great way. You know, we work directly with them, and you know, it's an established NGO, and everything is by the book very nicely. The other one is to send in money to Harvard University, because we do the accounting through Harvard University. So when we have all of the information in our website, it's childrenoftheborder.org. And that website is about to be put up in the next week. We have a volunteer from Canada who's working on it very hard. And our old website is childrenoftheborder.wordpress.com. But right now, since we're in transition between the websites, the best way, I think, is through the American Humanist Association.
Thank you, obviously, for the work that you did, you know, organizing relief efforts with the earthquake, but also just thank you for doing the work that you've been doing in Haiti for the past several years. I think it's really important, and And it sounds like it's becoming successful, and that's exciting. So thank you very much.
Yeah. Oh, no, thank you very much. And thank you for the for organizing the donations, the American Humanist Association, for that. Without the donors, I can have all the good intentions and all the knowledge and all the logistics organized. But without the money, the medicines don't get there. And people really responded very well. And that was that's what made it happen. So thank you.
That was our interview with Sebastian Velez from Harvard Atheists, Skeptics, and Humanists. As we mentioned, he's also the leader of Children of the Border. You can get more information about that at childrenoftheborder.wordpress.com. And if you're interested in donating to any of the relief efforts that are still happening in Haiti, you can do that through Humanist Charities, which is humanistcharities.org.
So, Jess, here's an interesting little postscript to our talk with Sebastian. I was just reading the news the other day, and it appears that those orphans, which the Christian missionary group were trying to bring into the Dominican Republic, which Sebastian had mentioned, they apparently all had parents. None of these kids were actually orphans, but they were just, you know, with their families or maybe with, you know, close relatives or whatnot. And the missionaries apparently kind of passed through town or whatever and offered to take the kids. And I don't know, is it exactly strong arming, but basically they were promising things like, we'll give them a better life, do this, do that. And the parents, you know, kind of in their desperation in that moment with, you know, nothing around them, I think they agreed to give these kids up and, you know. So it's pretty horrible, because it seems like maybe not every single person who was in that mission exactly knew the situation, but at least probably their leaders maybe realized that these kids weren't actually orphans.
Right, right. Now, I wonder if the missionaries were telling them, let us take your kids for now while you're rebuilding your community and your home, or if they were just saying, you know, this is not a condition that's suitable for raising children. Let us take them and we'll give them a good home.
Yeah, who knows? It's difficult to say. These stories like this, it's like you'll never really know the truth.
I have to say, though, I agree with Sebastian that no matter what, I think the best place is with the parents, with, you know, educating the parents and giving them the resources to raise their kids safely and healthily. And
Definitely. Taking kids out of their homes isn't always the best solution, doesn't necessarily solve certain problems.
So, Jenda, you've been on our show now for a while, and you've talked a little bit. You've given us bits and pieces about some of the volunteer work that you've done. I think now's a good time for us to talk, because I've also done some volunteer work. So did anything that Sebastian was talking about bring anything up for you, or did anything like resonate with you with your volunteer experience?
I think it did. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Republic of Cape Verde, which is a set of islands off of the west coast of Africa, off the coast of Senegal. And they were a former Portuguese colony until 1975, when they got their freedom. And they've been, they're full out democracy now, but they're kind of a one-party state for a while. And I was there for 2 years doing development work on one of the islands called Fogo. And the situation wasn't exactly the same as it was in Haiti, because Cape Verde, even though it's still very poor and there's still a lot of issues, was definitely, I'd have to say, it was better off than the situation in Haiti. There's still poverty and a lot of social issues and whatnot, but maybe not to the same degree. So it's kind of interesting to hear Sebastian talk about kind of, you know, what makes the most sense in terms of when you're going into a community and trying to work with people and things that don't work, which is kind of an example of what the missionaries were doing, where you can't kind of just fly in out of nowhere and, you know, offer to do all these things and just leave. There's, you know, development in the past has kind of been done like that. Now there's this kind of term of art for a lot of things called white elephants, which are just these buildings that, you know, well-meaning Westerners will come in and build, and they'll, you know, fund some big project and do something, but they won't actually kind of lay down the roots so that the community can kind of buy into these different projects. So sure, they'll build a new hospital for a community, but if you don't have the doctors and the nurses and the staff that are committed to being in that community and willing to stay there, you know, once the development people leave and maybe the locals lose interest, then that hospital is just going to kind of sit there and unused. And so that's one of the nice things about Peace Corps and kind of what Sebastian's doing too. It's like Peace Corps really wants you to develop roots in your community. That's part of the reason why it's a 2-year program. They want you in country for 2 years. You get language and cross-cultural training before you go.
That's great.
Yeah, into the community, and they really want you to integrate, and they really want you to kind of be part of that community. So, you know, it's always first few months of your time there, they just kind of want you to hang out and get to know people and then work on projects. And so in that same way, you know, it's there's kind of a better way to do things that's not so much just hit and run, and you end up with, you don't want to just go in and do a project and spend a lot of money and leave with no real results. And Peace Corps is kind of an example of how that works. So it was interesting to hear what Sebastian was saying too about development, because I think it's very closely tied, that idea of really going in, and because you need the buy-in from host country nationals to really get anything done in the long term. Like, you know, they always say that, you know, proverb about, you know, fishing and teaching a person to fish and all that. It's very, you know, it's a cliche almost at this point, but it's really true. It's really true. But what about you, Jess? I know you've done some volunteer stuff too.
What I did was called the IT Corps, which is pretty much like the Peace Corps with technology. And so I was in Botswana, which is just north of South Africa, so southern tip of Africa. And I worked with a YWCA, and I taught their teachers how to integrate technology into their program. I was only there for 3 months, and the situation of Botswana was, it's a very peaceful nation. It's one of the better off countries in Africa, financially speaking, which is probably why they're also peaceful. But it's also still a third world nation. And so I went there with a background here in the States of working with populations that were different from me, whether that's, you know, ethnically, racially, or socioeconomically speaking. And so I've always had the sort of understanding that that everyone is an expert at something, and each expertise should be equally valued. So while the program itself didn't give me the training that you got in sort of that cultural sensitivity and just speaking the different language and being a, you know, the ethics of being a visitor in a country, you know what I mean? And how to help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How to help without being sort of paternal. So I sort of had an understanding of that, but even still, when I was there, I was seeing the effects of this global monoculture. Like it was just the kids that were there walking down the street were wearing Chuck Taylors. They were listening to Ja Rule, and they were saying, "Yo, what's up?" And I was just kind of like, "Where am I?" You know. And I felt it's just not something that I want to see. And so I felt that here I was bringing technology and internet access to this organization. I'm like, I'm doing this. Like, I'm making this problem worse. So it kind of turned my world around.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're right. Even in Cape Verde too, because they have a lot of historic ties to the U.S. I saw a lot of the stuff related to kind of like the monoculture, but in other ways too. I don't know where you placed in a location where other Americans had been at before, but what's nice about, you know, what Peace Corps does and all sorts of volunteer agencies is that a lot of times when they place people, Westerners, especially Americans, in a place, in, you know, in some place maybe out, you know, not in the major cities and stuff like that. Sure, a lot of these kids see a lot of Western stuff. And yeah, like 50 Cent was really popular at my site. But, you know, they also meet you, and you're probably the first, like, American that they've met, like, in the flesh, face-to-face. So they kind of, even though, you know, they may still walk around talking about 50 Cent and everything like that and wearing Chuck Taylors or whatever, like, there's still kind of that, they still have that chance to interact with you and to kind of get a slightly more realistic view about, you know, what is it about, what really an American is, you know, who are these people, what do they do? Like, is it just what you see in the music video, or is it also kind of just regular people living their lives like they are and whatnot? So I think one of the greatest things about being able to volunteer overseas, especially if it's someplace that hasn't had a lot of previous exposure to Americans or whatnot, is that people really will get that better understanding of, oh, right, America isn't just what I see in the music videos or like this, you know, this DVD I have about, you know, Sylvester Stallone or whatever.
Exactly. No, I think you're right. And I think that as Americans going in and doing volunteer work or even just visiting other cultures, it's not just what we see and hear on the internet. Like what Sebastian was talking about in his interview is a perfect example of that, how all we see on the internet when we're looking up the earthquake in Haiti and relief efforts and rebuilding communities are the people from the capital, you know, living in these tent cities and doing poorly. And then But that's also what people are doing. You know, people are living even below that in the rural parts of the country. And that's not something that we know until, you know, we either talk to someone who's been there or we go there ourselves and try to do something to actually help build community.
Yeah, and it's hard because if you've had no, for a lot of people who didn't really know anything about Haiti or the situation on the ground beforehand, then once you see all this devastation, like it's hard, you know, to kind of know what actually came from the earthquake and what maybe had already been the conditions that were going on in Haiti at the time.
So what can we take as a moral from this story, I guess, is, I mean, doing, just learning, being more aware of what's happening in the world, you know, before disaster strikes, because, you know, not everyone is as well off as us.
Definitely. And I think everyone should consider doing volunteer service. And if you do travel overseas, I think it helps too if you try and visit some place, like even if you're going to the Caribbean and stuff, to kind of maybe avoid just going to like the big resorts where you can just lay on a beach and, you know, not have to spend any money and just stay in your resort area, but to kind of really get out and see the community or go to a smaller town, which I know sometimes that may not be feasible, may not be that easy if you can't, you can't just arrange something by yourself, but really getting immersed in the culture in a way that you can't just by being in a, you know, going from the airport and taking a taxi to the resort and spending all your time in a tourist area, that doesn't really give you a feel for the country. And I think things like that too can even help raise Americans and anyone's awareness about what the situation is in any country.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point. Great. Well, on that note, I think that about wraps it up for our show. Jendo, how about you?
Yeah, definitely. I think hopefully next month we will be doing a very interesting podcast. We're going to be podcasting live from New Jersey. We're going to be visiting an ethical culture society and doing some interviews. And we're actually going to be hosting their platform for that month. So for people who maybe haven't had a lot of background in ethical culture, know a lot about it, this will be your chance to get a little more information.
That's right, listeners. And if you feel like you want a little introduction to ethical society, you can tune into our show, HNN number 43, where Jenda interviews Kate Lovelady, who is the leader of the Ethical Society of St. Louis. You can download that show from our website, AmericanHumanist.org/HNN/podcast. While you're at that page, you can download any of our previous shows. You can also read the episode details from each of those shows. And you can see all the links that we've mentioned from any organization, any project, and any guests that we've had on our show.
And for those weeks with no podcast, you can always check out the Humanist Network News' e-zine, and you can go to AmericanHumanist.org/HNN to read up about what's going on in humanism and around the world.
And if you have any questions or comments about our show this month, questions for Sebastian, or questions about how to get involved with relief efforts in Haiti, or how to just become a volunteer through humanist charities, please feel free to email us at HNN@AmericanHumanist.org. Thanks for listening, folks. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Jenda Huang.